We have a new puppy at our house. His name is Jack. Every Tuesday night for 6 weeks now, we've been taking Jack to puppy socialization and training classes. It's a beginner class. Beginners for the pups and their people. So we don't take on a lot in any given 30-minute lesson. The first night, we learned nothing but the sit command. The second night, we added, well, I'm not sure, but it wasn't more than one or two things. And there's a lot of play time because you can't hold the puppy's attention for a long time, or mine, evidently. I'll nod my head vigorously while the trainer is telling us what to do, and I encourage my pup and all the other pups equally. I make a commitment to practice Jack's new tricks at home, and I try. But here's where the difficulty comes in. Though I nodded enthusiastically and encouraged my pup to learn his new tricks, I get home and find I haven't learned them at all. Do I say sit or only make the hand motion? Do I say yes or do I say good boy? When am I supposed to touch my nose? Or am I supposed to touch my nose at all? No more than one or two new commands every class, which are repeated numerous times in the course of 30 minutes, and more than half of that 30 minutes is playtime and potty time. No more than one or two new commands, and I can't remember. By the time I get home, I'm a failure at puppy training. Now imagine this. Imagine that if instead of one or two new tricks, the puppy trainer said on the first night, okay, I'm going to tell you everything you need to know about puppies and dogs in the next few minutes. First, determine if your puppy is food motivated or praise motivated. Never give a dog chocolate because chocolate is toxic to dogs because it contains theobromine and to a lesser extent caffeine. Humans metabolize theobromine easily, but dogs don't. Never give your puppy grapes or raisins because tartaric acid and potassium bitartrate. Carrots and apples are good for your pup and peanut butter, but not if it contains xylitol, which is a sugar substitute, because it's toxic to dogs. Your puppy must have all four rounds of vaccines and boosters before he is protected from rabies, or maybe they'd slow it down to make it easier. Your puppy must have four rounds of vaccines and boosters before he is protected from rabies, distemper, adenovirus, parvovirus, and must have heartworm prevention every single month. And what are the odds that I could take that in? I would be scared to death. I would assume everything is a danger to my dog. I'd have no chance because every bit of wisdom that I need to receive about my puppy was rolled into a one-time presentation. I'd be overwhelmed. And that is what the Sermon on the Mount is like. We're beginning a new sermon series today on Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, the part of Matthew's gospel that begins with the 5th chapter and continues through the 6th and the 7th. And we call it a sermon. You've heard that, right? We call it a sermon. And I've always imagined, I don't know about you, but I've always imagined Jesus having all these people sitting down and he's preaching to them and they're nodding, but unlike you, they're taking it in. I may have just crossed the line. But it's not really a sermon. It's more like an index of all of Jesus's teachings rolled into one. If you've ever sat down and actually read through, you'll see that there's this part and there's this part, and then with no transition whatsoever, no segue, there's this part, and then we jump back to another part, and it's all there. We speak of the Sermon on the Mount as if it's one single sermon preached on one single occasion, but it's far more than that. There are lots of reasons to believe that the Sermon on the Mount is far more than one sermon, that it's in fact a kind of a representative summary of all the sermons Jesus ever preached. Some scholars say that it should be called the ordination address rather than the Sermon on the Mount, because they point out that especially in Luke's gospel, but also in Matthew's, this Sermon on the Mount comes right after the disciples are called. And they suggest that after Jesus definitely chose his 12 disciples, he may have taken them away to a quiet place for a week or even a longer period of time. And during that time, he may have taught them everything that he was thinking was important for them to know, and that later they came back and distilled it into this Sermon on the Mount. Thomas Jefferson called the Sermon on the Mount the most sublime and benevolent code of morals which has ever been offered. Not the Ten Commandments, but the Sermon on the Mount. Robin Myers, author of the book Saving Jesus from the Church, said this about the Sermon on the Mount: "Strangely, we have come to a moment in human history when the message of the Sermon on the Mount could indeed save us, but it can no longer be heard above the din of dueling doctrines." Consider this, he says, there is not a single word in that sermon about what to believe, only words about what to do. If you'll stay with us for the next couple of months, you'll hear that for yourself. Not what you must believe, but what a life of faith compels you to do. We start with Matthew chapter 5, and I'm going to read through this section called the Beatitudes to you. This is where it starts. Matthew 5, chapter 1, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he began to speak and taught them, saying — I'm going to interrupt myself right there, because for the first time this week, I really see this differently. In my mind, I've seen Godspell, right? All the people following Jesus, and then they all go up, and they sit all around him, and he starts telling them these amazing things, but that's not what it says. So Jesus has been healing people, and people are starting to follow him. And when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on the mountain. And we know how often he did that, right? He took himself away to a quiet place. So when he saw the crowds, he went up on the mountain. And after he sat down, his disciples came to him, those maybe that he had just called. And he began to speak. "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." The Beatitudes. One word, the Beatitudes. When I was a child, I thought the name of this section was the Attitudes. As I grew older and learned more about the world, I struggled with what these Beatitudes — I finally got it right — what these Beatitudes meant for me. Why did Jesus call all these people blessed? Was it even blessed or blessed? Did it make a difference? Probably not. But the poor in spirit, blessed? The meek, blessed? By whom? by God? Did God have a special place in God's own heart for these people described in the Beatitudes? Or were these sayings actually about my attitude toward the people described here? Should I bless the pure in heart? Should I bless the peacemakers? And how do I bless them? By honoring them, praising them, studying them? This week I learned something new about these Beatitudes from Reverend William Barclay. See if this clears anything up for you. It made a big difference for me. William Barclay was writing many years ago, before some of you were born. And for him, the authorized version of the Bible was the King James Bible. And what he pointed out in what I was reading this week was that if you read the Beatitudes in the King James Bible, in all these Beatitudes, you will see that the word R, A-R-E, is italicized. Why is it italicized? He says because when a word appears in italics in the King James Version, it means that in the Greek or in the Hebrew, there is no equivalent word to that word. And that word in italics had to be added to help bring meaning to today's readers. So what he points out is that in the Beatitudes, there is no verb, which we would find very hard to follow, so they added the word A-R-E. They gave us a verb. William Barclay says that when Jesus originally spoke the Beatitudes, he would have spoken them in Aramaic, a kind of Hebrew that people spoke in his day. And a fairer translation of what Jesus would have actually said would have been, "Oh, the blessedness of. Oh, the blessedness of." Not blessed are the, but oh, the blessedness of. This morning, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to remind you that the Sermon on the Mount is just like a greatest hits list. It's just a little index, a little guidebook. But behind each little piece is a story. And number two, I want to remind you that the blessed are is just for our convenience. But a truer reading might be, oh, the blessedness of. And I want to jump into the Beatitudes like that. And I'm not going to go through all of them because we don't have time, but just a few. Oh, the blessedness of the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. I used to worry about who are these poor in spirit? Are they people who are depressed? Are they people who are down? Are they people who are suffering? If you open it up and you look at all the stories and you remember that behind each of these is a story, what happens? Well, oh, the blessedness of the poor in spirit. So I have come to understand this week that poor in spirit is not about a person being depressed or down. To be poor in spirit really means more like to know in your spirit that you have nowhere else to go but to God. To be poor in spirit is to believe that you have nowhere else to go but to God. And then, remember this. Oh, the blessedness of the poor in spirit. Who's the poor in spirit? The one that has nowhere else to go. What about the Canaanite woman that we talked about just a few weeks ago who came to, to Jesus and said, my daughter is sick. My daughter is dying. You can save her. Have mercy on me. Her spirit was poor. It was empty. She knew she had nowhere to turn but to Jesus. Oh, the blessedness of that woman. I don't have to make a value judgment. I don't have to worry about who's going to bless her. I just need to be in her presence for a minute. Oh, the blessedness of that woman whose spirit had nowhere left to go but God. And Jesus said, oh, such faith. And your faith has made your daughter well. Oh, the blessedness of the meek. I don't have to worry about being a doormat for Christ or all the other things I can think up. Oh, the blessedness of the meek. The meek are those who don't rely only on their own understanding. The meek are those who know that there is a will beyond their own. That is the will of God. And so when the man came to Jesus and said, my son has these fits and he's dying. My son has these fits and he's dying. And Jesus said, okay, tell me more. And the man said, I need him to be healed. Can you make him well? And Jesus says, can I make him well? All things are possible. And this meek father who knows that there is a will beyond his own and that there is more than what he can understand said, I believe and help my unbelief. Jesus, help my unbelief. And then one more. Oh, the blessedness of you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. How easy it is for us Christians to get caught up in that one, right? Because we are always the persecuted ones, not the ones doing the persecuting. But I started thinking, okay, this Sermon on the Mount is just a guidebook. It's just an index. There are stories behind all these. What's the story behind that one? And I thought first of Peter. So Jesus has been arrested and is on trial, and it's not going to go well, and everybody knows it. And Peter is kind of slinking around in the firelight, and they see him. And it was dangerous to be associated with Jesus. And they see him. That's one of them there. And Peter, knowing what could come of that, says, No. And then again, that's one of them. I've seen him with Jesus. And Jesus and Peter knows what that could mean. So, no, I'm not one of them. And then one more. That's a Galilean. He must be with Jesus. And you know what that means. And so Peter knows what it means. And he says, No, not me. And then he goes away, and he is devastated because of what could have happened to him and that he denied Jesus. Blessed, oh, the blessedness of those. Oh, the blessedness of those who are persecuted or reviled or misunderstood or attacked for Jesus' sake. All of a sudden, I don't have to judge Peter. I don't have to figure out if Jesus is going to take care of him later. Oh, the blessedness of that man finding himself in that situation on that night. And my heart goes out to him. I think that's a much better purpose for the Beatitudes than to try to memorize them or define them or compartmentalize them, but know that there is more and let my heart go out. Oh, the blessedness of it helps me step outside the saying, not worry about what God is going to do or what I should do even, to step outside of the beatitude and into the story and to be overwhelmed and to know what it feels like to be the meek. God, I believe, but it's a weak little belief. Help my unbelief. To be desperate. God, my child is sick and there is nowhere else to turn. To be afraid like Peter. I want to end this morning by staying there and oh, the blessedness of, but also bringing in one more piece. Reverend Rob Bell, I know you've heard his name, a few years ago offered to the world what he understood to be the new Beatitudes. And I have taken a little bit of liberty and I have changed his Beatitudes to read, oh, the blessedness of. And I want to leave you with that this morning. Oh, the blessedness of those who don't have it all together. Oh, the blessedness of those who have run out of strength, ideas, willpower, resolve, or energy. Oh, the blessedness of those who ache because of how severely out of whack the world is. Oh, the blessedness of those who stumble, trip, and fall in the same place again and again. Oh, the blessedness of those who on a regular basis have a dark day in which despair seems to be a step behind them wherever they go. Oh, the blessedness of you. For God is with you. God is on your side. God meets you in that place. The gospel is the counterintuitive, joyous, exuberant news that Jesus has brought the unending, limitless, stunning love of God to even us. Oh, the blessedness. Amen.